This is NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This summer, we've all heard the story from the southern U.S. border of a sudden surge of children from Central America crossing illegally into this country and of the federal government scrambling to get the situation under control. Now, these far-off developments are hitting close to home, with several New England states being asked to temporarily house these young migrants while the courts consider their cases. So far, Connecticut has said no, Massachusetts yes, and Vermont maybe. New Hampshire hasn't been asked yet anyway, but the issue has become fodder for our midterm elections. And for candidates from both parties, the border troubles have once again raised a subject that everyone thought was off the agenda this year: reform of our immigration system. And that's what we're looking at today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. What's your take on why this is happening and what might resolve this? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Jessica Vaughn is with us by phone, Director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies. She's also an instructor on immigration policy at Northwestern University Center for Public Safety and a former State Department employee. And Jessica Vaughn, really good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Also with us in studio, Fergus Cullen, former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party, principal of Fergus Cullen Communications, and founder of Americans by Choice, a national organization supporting immigration reform. And Fergus, good to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Also with us, Ron Abramson, New Hampshire immigration lawyer, founder of Immigration Solutions. Ron himself is a naturalized citizen originally from Chile. And Ron, good to see you too. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
And Ron, I want to start with you, but obviously hear from everybody. You know, even though there's been a ton of coverage about this, we've been hearing about this in detail for weeks. What do you think, Ron, most people might not understand about this? What are most people not getting?
That's a big question, Laura. Thanks for starting me off with it. The issue is obviously much more nuanced than it's often portrayed in the media. The media tends to go into black and white mode on an issue like this. And when we're getting not just facts, but opinions mixed in with some facts, some misapprehended facts, we're not getting the full story. The bottom line is that there is a humanitarian crisis in several countries in Central America, and we are feeling the effects of that crisis at our southern border right now. And there are people who, by and large, are good, loving parents who want their children not to be recruited into violent, narco-trafficking-related gangs or to be killed for not joining those gangs, and therefore they are seeking any alternative that may create a vehicle for their children to be safe.
You know, there's been a big question that a lot of people are asking, in addition to why, and you've touched on that, Ron, but why now? What do you think about that, Ron? Why now?
Because the situation in Central America is worsening. The perception that there's somehow a view abroad that we have a soft policy or that the administration's decision to allow certain groups of younger children to stay here, or younger people, now younger adults, to stay here if they had arrived at a certain point, that's a red herring. That is not an issue that is fueling this, because people, if nothing else, people who want to navigate the U.S. immigration system tend to have a pretty good understanding of what the rules and the law state. And it does no good for any juvenile to come here thinking that they're going to benefit from a law where they had to be here before 2007.
Well, and Jessica Vaughn, from your vantage point, what are some of the myths versus realities with this story? Again, there's been a ton of coverage, but a lot of misunderstandings as well.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that are not understood well. And part of the reason for that is that there has not been a lot of hard information released by the federal government about the numbers, about the conditions, and so on. But what we do know is that, indeed, there is poverty and a general lack of economic opportunity in the three countries in Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, that have been sending most of these folks north. But that has been the case for a long time. And, in fact, you know, a lot of experts have a view different from what we just heard, in that really conditions have been improving a little bit in some of these countries. But what the thing that's important to understand is, first of all, that this surge of people, which has been building for a couple of years and started getting worse in the fall and then even worse than that in the spring, is primarily made up of families traveling together, a parent or two parents with kids. And about one-third of this surge is kids coming by themselves. Most of those kids are rejoining their parents who left them in Central America a while ago. And the reason that they're coming now is because they know that, by experience, that they will be allowed, that the kids, anyone traveling with kids, either as a family or if the kids are coming in a group or with smugglers or what have you, that they're going to be treated leniently. They're going to be allowed to stay in the United States. And this isn't really rumor. This is exactly what has been happening for the last couple of years. So they, you know, realize that now is a good time to take advantage of the lax immigration enforcement that we've had.
So
this is really a family reunification process that's happening here.
So the unaccompanied minor headline, Jessica, you're saying is about a third of the issue. The other is families coming from Central America here.
That's exactly right. That's what we know from the few numbers that have been released by the Department of Homeland Security and also from some intelligence reports that we've had. 95% of the people who have turned themselves over to the Border Patrol have told them that they're doing it because they heard that they would be allowed to stay, and that they've heard that from friends and family members who've come before them.
And this has to do with the 2008 law that I want to ask all of you about in just a moment. But Fergus Cullen, not forgetting you, how do you view this story? How do you think it's being told in general by the media? And what do you think is we're getting wrong, getting right about it?
Yeah, I think, number one, that this current crisis shows that our legal immigration system is broken and needs to be modernized and reformed. You know, the border has never been as secure as it is today. It is incredibly more secure than it was, say, two decades ago. So this idea that it's completely porous and completely out of control is really ignoring the progress that's been made in terms of border security. But the way to curb illegal immigration is to make it easier for people to enter the country legally and also to exit the country legally. This means visa reform for higher skilled, higher education workers. It also means a guest worker program for your lower skilled, lesser educated workers, which allows people, for example, to cross the border in both directions legally. Because right now we have something like the Hotel California. You know, you can check in, but you can't ever leave. And so if you had a guest worker program, that would really address 90% of the legitimate concerns people have about the border. Because if you give people a choice between a legal entry and an illegal entry, they'll line up for the legal option. So, you know, line up here. Your ID gets checked, you get a guest worker permit, you get an ID number, so you're working on the books, and you have the ability to go back and forth across the border. And that would solve most of the problems and the legitimate concerns people have.
And you're focusing on the economic issues, as many others have. And I've heard others say if we had a good guest worker program, we wouldn't see some of these problems. But a lot of people, Fergus, and I know you know this, are looking at the humanitarian end, that some of these kids, especially teenage boys, have said, look, I didn't want to be in a drug gang. I saw my friends get killed. So fold that into this economic issue that you see.
You know, this is a sign of American exceptionalism. You know, people in Bo don't grow up as teenagers or tweens or the parents of them hoping for a better life for their kid by sending them to Guatemala or to Canada for that matter. The fact that people want to come to the United States because they see it as a land of opportunity is still something that we should take pride in. And what we do need to do is make sure that there's a legitimate system in place for people to be able to do that in a way that benefits our economy here.
Again, the phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're looking once again at immigration reform in light of what's been happening on the southern U.S. border, the surge of children coming in from Central America, and now some New England states being asked to temporarily house some of these young migrants. What do you think of this situation? What questions do you have about it? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Ron, I'd love your thoughts, too, on the idea that this is a humanitarian crisis. These children are refugees. Or these are people coming in for the same reasons that people have always come in, economic opportunity. What's your take on that?
I don't think this is an economic refugee issue. In other words, these are not people coming for pursuit of the American dream in economic terms. There's a lot of maybe anecdotal and also some more empirical evidence that this is not an issue of poverty in these countries. This is an issue of chaos and violence. And we have clearly defined rules about what a refugee is in this country. And it involves a type of persecution either at the hands of the government or at the hands of groups known to the government which the government is unable or unwilling to control. And in this case, any of us who has children, who was in a situation where we didn't see any way out to keep our children safe, would probably resort to whatever means we had at our disposal. And knowing that some people had managed to send their children to the United States and those children at last calling were still healthy, safe, alive, might make us all entertain this sort of issue. So I keep coming back to the fact that there is a moral imperative to treat these children humanely, to let them air out their cases, and to see where the existing process leads.
Do you think they should be classified as refugees?
On a case-by-case basis,
yes.
We also have the ability from an executive branch standpoint to declare any of these countries eligible for temporary protected status. We do it with El Salvador. We've done it with Haiti. We do it when there's a natural disaster in a certain country, and we let those people stay here temporarily in what is, by some accounts, not a particularly effective status, but allows them to remain legally. That gets reviewed annually, and we assess the conditions in the country before we decide whether or not to send people back.
Well, and New Hampshire is familiar with refugees because we've had a large influx in recent years. I want to ask our other guests, too, about that point after a short break. And we'll take some of your emails and calls, too. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. So Jessica and Fergus, when we come back, we'll talk about this idea of, are they refugees? Are they not? We'll also look at New England being requested to take some of these children while their cases are resolved. All that coming up, plus your thoughts and comments. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Only 6 days left until the early bird drawing for NHPR's car raffle. Don't miss out on your chance to win $2,000 of gas gift cards from Irving Oil and help support NHPR at the same time. Go to nhpr.org to buy your tickets today. Partly to mostly sunny for today. Could see some isolated showers this afternoon in the North Country. High temperatures upper 70s to the lower 80s. Partly cloudy tonight. Some areas of fog after midnight. Lows tonight upper 50s to lower 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Orthopedics and team physicians for the UNH Wildcats. Providing repair for knee and shoulder injuries for UNH athletes. SOSmed.org. And the Barnstormers Theater in Tamworth presenting One Man, Two Governors, a comedy of mistaken identity, July 22nd through the 26th. Tickets at barnstormerstheater.com. 920, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about immigration and the recent surge in minors crossing the U.S.-Mexico border from Central America. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, Jessica Vaughn, I did want your thoughts, too. Some folks have said that these children should be processed and sent back quickly, as quickly as possible. Others have said, no, they're refugees from the violence in Central America. They should be allowed to stay. Should they be classified as refugees or not, Jessica? What do you think?
Well, there may be a few who are genuinely fleeing some violence that was directed at them or persecution that was directed at them. But most of them, in fact, are coming from parts of their country that are not necessarily affected by the violence and or, you know, would have the ability to relocate somewhere closer to home. There may be a few, and I think we ought to give people the opportunity to be heard on their, you know, if they qualify for asylum. But mostly what they're telling the Border Patrol when they get here is that they're coming to because they heard they would be allowed to stay and rejoin their family members. So, you know, that's a tough Paul, that's a tough case to make, that they deserve some kind of special treatment under the law, because, of course, if they're allowed to stay without any repercussions, that is a slap in the face to, the million or more people that are navigating our legal immigration system and who, rightfully ought to be upset that, they're being made to wait and delay their processing because we're taking in all these people who are basically just taking advantage of the lack of enforcement to come here illegally. So we have some hard choices to make. If it is even a refugee crisis, is the solution to actually let an unlimited number of people resettle here in the United States? Or is there more we could do to help them in their own countries that would be more of a permanent solution and more fair to everyone and still preserve the integrity of our legal immigration system? Nobody wants to send people back to their death if that is in fact the case. On the other hand, I think we really do need to take a clear-eyed look at what the causes of this are and what the implications are for the communities in the United States who are going to be absorbing these people, because some of them are already taking significant numbers of refugees from all parts of the world. And there are some fiscal issues that come into play in terms of schooling and health care. I mean, I think we're really going to start to see the impact on U.S. communities come September, when a lot of these, the nearly 60,000 kids who are expected to arrive, by September are going to need to be put into the school system, and how that's going to affect the cities and towns that are accommodating them. And I know some cities and towns in Massachusetts that have been seeing this influx of unaccompanied kids for the last couple of years know that it can be a struggle to meet their needs adequately and also manage the rest of their budget, and that there is an impact on their ability to provide services because of the numbers. So, there are a lot of questions here and things that need to be balanced. And, as I said, nobody wants to send anyone back to their death if that is, in fact, what would happen. But we cannot simply expect to allow an unlimited stream of people to keep coming. We need to look at what we can do to deter people from coming if, it's a family reunification or economic opportunity quest that they're on.
Fergus, what do you think?
Well, I think that the focus of the 50,000 young people coming to the border is a bit of a distraction from some of the bigger immigration issues. There's the existing population of some 11 million undocumented people living among us in our communities already. The 50,000 is, a very small number.
Sounds like a lot.
Relative to that. And there's a subtext to the discussion that's been going on that's a little bit ugly. I mean, there are some people out there who are in favor of a reformed legal immigration system, and there are others who are anti-immigration, period. And there's, we've seen some spurts of this ugliness. I mean, some of these protests that we saw in California, for example, these are not rallies in favor of a legal modern immigration system. These are saying, we don't want you in our community. Go find someplace else to go. And that's pretty ugly. We saw an anti-immigration rally in Rochester last week, Rochester, New Hampshire. That was, a little bit ugly. We had a congressional candidate here, Frank Ginto, last week, suggesting that it's okay to check the backgrounds of families that might end up hosting some of the young people who are coming in, background checks on them, checking their their immigration status. Listen, this is a Gestapo-like tactic. What about the Constitution? What about due process? What's this suspicion, this assumption that other people are breaking the law? I mean, why don't we just ask if they're Jewish while we're there and keep a government registry of that? Of course, we wouldn't tolerate that. We wouldn't accept it. But some people out there are making these exact arguments. And that's completely wrong. Keep in mind that 40% of people who are here in an undocumented status entered the country perfectly legally, came in on a visa, probably overstayed it, and then fell into an undocumented status, perhaps with plans to do that all along. And the focus on this 50,000 population ignores all that.
I want to ask you guys another question and then go to our listeners. This is a biggie. And Fergus, I'm going to turn to you first because I know that comprehensive long-term immigration reform is something that your group is all about. I mean, that's why you founded it. Some people say this crisis shows the need for long-term comprehensive immigration reform. Others say that this crisis shows an obsession with comprehensive immigration reform has meant a blind eye to the short-term immigration problems, like the kids that we're seeing now on the border. What do you think? I want to hear from everybody, but Fergus, you first. What do you think? I mean, are we so focused on this long-term goal that we've forgotten this sort of short-term crisis, or vice versa?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of distrust on the issue, and that's a big problem. You know, even the DREAM Act, which President Obama basically said he was going to introduce by executive order by fiat, has led to a huge amount of distrust on the right, including among people who are otherwise in favor of doing something to modernize the immigration system, but they don't trust this administration to enforce existing law or to change the rules of the game after an agreement has been reached. That's a really legitimate concern that a lot of people have on the right, and so it's very hard to come up with something when people think, well, you know, the president is just going to, we're going to put a couple extra judges in and try and process this group of young people now, but they're basically all going to be allowed to stay here on a permanent basis. And people are very uncomfortable with that as well.
Yeah. What do you think, Ron? And Jessica, to you too. But Ron, go ahead. Are we sort of ignoring the long term in favor of the short term, or vice versa?
The problem is that at any given time, we have allocated a certain number of resources for the entirety of the immigration spectrum. And depending on what seems to be the particularly hot button issue of the moment, we need to reallocate resources within that finite pool. The Immigration Service under the Department of Homeland Security has an enormous mission and is never, as with most federal agencies, adequately funded to fulfill every aspect of that mission. So on the one hand, we won't give enough resources to the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which is actually under the Department of Justice, to have enough judges to process these kids, then we complain that there are long delays which allow people to stay. So we can't really have it both ways. If we're going to be a nation of laws, we are going to need to make sure that we have adequate resources to allow the legal process to work.
Well, Ron, the Washington Post did a huge story on this situation recently, said that the problem on the border had actually been brewing for, you know, at least 2 years, that the Obama administration put it off, ignored it, in favor of what it wanted was this comprehensive immigration reform. And it viewed the border situation as a distraction, as a local problem. What do you think? I mean, have we been so focused on this big goal that we're ignoring the crisis right at our doorstep?
I would put it in these terms, Laura. When you have a leaky faucet, you have two options. You can get a bucket or you can fix the leak. And we've chosen over and over again to get a bucket. We haven't chosen to fix the leak. And that's what would be comprehensive immigration reform. We need a system that seems more fair and that, as Fergus has touched upon, catches up with modern realities. The world is a global community now, and our laws go back over 100 years, and we've made this patchwork system that is inconsistent, incoherent, and by and large, dysfunctional. That's that part I think most people would agree on. What your priority is, that's where we fall into different camps. And yes, we have approximately 10, 11 million people here who are out of status with whom we are not dealing because we can't get it together. The Senate passed a comprehensive immigration reform bill last year. It languishes and languishes and languishes because in a midterm election year, it's hard to get any traction in Congress to do something about this.
Jessica, I love your thoughts. And if you could also fold in a response to some of the concerns Fergus raised, that in some instances this is getting ugly, you know, checking people's papers and so forth. Go ahead, Jessica.
Yes. I mean, at the, you know, the risk of having someone misunderstand my motivations for saying this, I have to say that there is a very good reason for checking the background of people who are taking custody of children. And that is because we need to make sure that the people that we're putting a child in the care of are actually who they say they are and don't have some other illicit or, you know, illegal or horrifying reason for taking custody of the children. We know that the trafficking organizations do exploit weaknesses in our immigration system. And, you know, even especially in the state I live in, Massachusetts, we've had some problems in our foster care system. You know, it's unconscionable not to check the background of somebody that you're putting a kid in the care of. So that's, you know, first of all. But with regard to the larger immigration system here, I have to say, this crisis is really the best evidence that we have that when there is talk of a large amnesty or when there is very lax immigration enforcement, as we've had, then that does inspire people to come. And that this is the best evidence we've had of that yet. There's a good reason that that Gang of Eight immigration reform bill is pretty much dead, and that is because it was very unpopular. And so it's not that people don't want to address immigration reform. It's just that there are very different ideas of how to go about it. And the position of many people in the House of Representatives is that we have to have a credible enforcement system first to make sure that any rules that are agreed upon are actually going to be followed before we can undertake this, you know, a doubling of legal immigration, a doubling of guest workers, which is what that bill did, and a massive amnesty. So people just want to take it step by step and make sure we're doing it right first. And there's no question that the administration did look the other way at this crisis brewing because it ran counter to their narrative that the Obama administration had been the most effective on immigration enforcement in recent memory. You know, clearly that was not the case when we had tens of thousands of families and unaccompanied kids breaching our border. So, you know, I think that now the public is going to demand that this crisis be resolved to people's satisfaction. And if people are going to be permanently resettled here because they've come in this crisis, then that has implications for the rest of our legal immigration system and for our labor markets and so on. And those need to settle before we can talk about, you know, any other massive overhaul.
Let's take some calls, if we could, some questions and comments from our listeners. Email exchange at nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And Sarah's joining us from Contoocook. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I think if you're against help taking in these children, you're not looking at the long-run benefit to this country. We are an aging population, and we are not reproducing ourselves. For example, Social Security researchers are predicting that Social Security will not be solvent 30 years from now because they see that the payroll tax income is going to go down and down and down as we lose workers, as the workforce does not grow fast enough. We're a country that can take in young people and turn them into middle-class people who contribute mightily to the economy. And also, you ought in the long run, you know how to think, who's going to take care of you in the nursing home when you're 80 or 90? We need these young energies.
Okay, Sarah, thank you for calling in. Ron, what do you think?
I think that's
especially given New Hampshire's demographic problem, as we all hear about.
It's an excellent perspective, and taking a long view is the way to create and craft effective solutions to this. But that's the problem. When you govern and amend policy in crisis mode, you never really address the long-term view. And that has been an ongoing vicious cycle for at least a decade now, because we were starting to have some meaningful discussions about immigration reform in 2004, 2005. They came to a head in 2006. George W. Bush couldn't marshal any allies on his side of the aisle to get immigration reform when there was some momentum for it. And then it just gets put off, and it becomes this, you know, this political hot potato every 4 years. And we move a certain number of people towards doing something, and then there are a number of people who are too concerned about immediate political repercussions to act.
You know, is anybody, Ron, talking about, you know, we talk about, you know, Massachusetts or Vermont and various states being asked to temporarily house these children while their cases are resolved in court. Is anyone talking about permanent status?
Certainly not now. Nobody's saying that let's just wave these kids in, give them a health check and send them on their way. Right now, the issue is what is the legal, fair, humane way to deal with largely unaccompanied minors. I don't know where this anecdotal evidence comes that that's a minority of the people streaming across. It seems that there are, you know, various ways to cherry pick one's information to support one's own view, and I'm not necessarily going to disavow my own role in doing the same. But the bottom line is that we need to give these kids a hearing. And we need to figure out a status such as refugee status or temporary protected status that addresses this problem now and allows us to think longer term.
And the reason we're talking about housing is because these court processes take a long time.
Correct. And because we don't...
Many months.
We don't have, and I don't believe we want, to create detention camps full of young, unaccompanied, unstructured, or overly structured children. We want to allow them to have some semblance of dignity and a life while the process works itself out.
Well, and speaking of housing people, housing children, while they're waiting for their court cases, Jessica, to you first, over and over, people involved in this keep referring to the 2008 law signed by President Bush as partly contributing to this situation where, yes, you have to have a court hearing if you're a minor, and yes, that process can take months. So in the meantime, what do? What is that law? What's its role in this? Because this comes up everywhere.
What people are referring to is a 2008 reauthorization of a law intended to protect kids who were the victim of human trafficking. In other words, when they were essentially kidnapped and, you know, sold as a commodity either for the sex trade or for some kind of involuntary servitude in somebody's household. It's really the administration's interpretation of that law that is causing the problem. They are basically defining any child who arrives in the United States without a parent or guardian at the time to benefit from certain protections created under this act, which mean that they are entitled to a slow walk process through our immigration system. They're entitled to services, shelter, an attorney to represent them, and so on. And in fact, as I've described before, most of the kids who have arrived in this surge are not trafficked. Their parents paid a smuggler to bring them over. And most of them are, in fact, rejoining family members when they get here. So they are no longer unaccompanied and shouldn't qualify for the special green card programs that exist specifically for true unaccompanied trafficked minors. So, I mean, and there is a green card available, and what's happening is that instead of trying to pare down to the most egregious or sympathetic cases, the administration is simply designated all of these kids as unaccompanied minors, turned them over to Health and Human Services and said, you know, give them the services, give them a lawyer, give them a court date, you know, between 2 and 5 years in the future, and let the communities where they relocate handle schooling, health care, and all the other services that they need.
And that's the concern you raised earlier about local cost. And we'll follow up on that after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
Don't miss out on $2,000 worth of gas. That's enough to fuel a cross-country trip several times over. And that's what's on the table with the early bird prize for NHPR's summer car raffle. But not for much longer. You only have a few days left to get in on this, so get your raffle tickets now, just $50 each or three for $100. Before you do anything else, call 1-888-805-NHPR or go to nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Landmark College in Putney, Vermont, offering a professional certificate in universal design with technology integration, online and blended courses, online at landmark.edu. Emma Washington Cog Railway for 145 years, climbing to the top of New England, now offering special events on both steam and biodiesel trains. Tickets at thecog.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, Islam expert Leslie Hamilton joins us. We'll talk to her tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, the national debate on immigration and New England reaction to the surge in minors crossing the U.S.-Mexico border from Central America. You can join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. What's your reaction to what we see happening on our southern border? What do you think might help resolve this situation? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The exchange number again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And here's an email from Rob that came in that I want to share with all of you. People who are protesting busloads of newly arrived immigrants coming to their communities are not necessarily anti-immigration. They are anti-immigration. illegal immigration. Rob says we have laws and a process for legal immigration, and that process is being trampled on by allowing hundreds of thousands to skip the process by claiming asylum. Rob says we need to secure the borders first, use the legal immigration process, and pass common sense reform ASAP, and that does not include mass amnesty. Rob, thank you very much for the email. A couple points there, but Fergus, he's first of all reacting to what you said about the protesters greeting busloads of newly arrived immigrants.
Yeah, when people think that an existing law is impractical or doesn't work, they break it. So if people think that the speed limit at 55 miles an hour is unreasonable, they go faster than that. If people think that prohibition doesn't meet with their sensibilities about what law should be, they violate the law on prohibition. So when people have a broken system on immigration and they can't enter the country legally, we shouldn't be surprised that human nature is, to find another way to do it. Now, there's a distinction between full citizenship and legal status, and this is sort of a middle ground. You know, there are some who say turn everybody away at the border or at the embassy when they're applying for a visa and shut down immigration completely. And then there are others who say come one, come all, open borders like our country had, I might add, for the first 150 years of its existence. A completely open border system seemed to work for the country then, I might point out.
It was a different country back then, Fergus.
Sure thing. So we need to modernize our laws, which are outdated and don't apply to our current system at all. But legal status, where again, people are guest workers, something in between citizenship and being undocumented. In some cases, it's a green card. In other cases, it's a work permit. And that solves most of the problems. Oh, and by the way, other legitimate concerns people have. You know, you got to stay out of – it's a probationary status. You have to otherwise be staying out of trouble while you're here. So a drug offense, for example, could lead to swift and certain deportation if you're here in a probationary status. And again, a legitimate concern that some people have is that that would never happen, that we can't be sure of a swift and certain deportation for people who, you know, commit violent crimes and felonies and that kind of thing while they're in that probationary status, like we would have for, say, natural-born U.S. citizens who are on probation.
You know, our emailer, Rob, also brings up, Ron, mass amnesty and, you know, not allowing thousands to skip the process by claiming asylum and so forth. Can you address that concern as well as the concern that Jessica raised before the break, which is, look, if you let, you know, all these kids come, all of them stay, there is a strain on local resources, schools and health resources and so forth. Mayor Ted Gatsis of Manchester said over the weekend, you know, he's concerned because he's been struggling with refugees in his city. So what do you think? This idea of mass asylum is not a good idea.
Again, that sort of rolls back to when and whether we can reform the immigration system as a whole, because we say a lot of very nice, civilized sounding things like this is unfair to those people doing it legally.
Which is what Rob says, yeah.
Right. And the problem with that statement, it sounds good, but it just does not reflect the reality of the current legal immigration system. And you see this in the individual family context, and you see it in the business context. I have family immigration petitions that require my clients to wait anywhere from 4 years to 20 years, depending on what country they're from and what the relationship is between the family members. I have business clients in southern New Hampshire who are ready to double their technical workforce, but because of the lottery with the caps for business visas, got shut out of two-thirds of the applications that we submitted this year. Those are not workable systems. And if we really do want to fall back on the argument that we care about those people doing it legally, then we should make the legal system function the way it needs to function in the modern American world.
Well, and one thing we can all agree on, probably easier said than done, Ron. I mean, as you said earlier, many have tried and none have succeeded.
Exactly. But then we can't use that as an argument for why we're not going to proceed a certain way when we are faced with a discrete crisis in the immigration system.
Why is it so hard, Jessica? Why do people keep trying to reform this system and it never gets done?
Well, because there are genuine and legitimate disagreements about what should be done and where the lines should be drawn, and what are we going to focus on? Family-based immigration, which is probably about 75% of our, if not more, of our current legal immigration system, or are we going to have a system that gives priority to people who have skills that are needed in our economy, or humanitarian immigration. And it's always where the limit is going to be that causes the problem. And, you know, but the idea is that once we establish a limit that people agree on, then it has to be enforced. And, you know, and then people object to that. So, you know, I think most Americans cherish our national tradition of a generous immigration policy and welcoming people for whatever reason. But the problem is that it's not a free lunch either for the economy. The economic evidence shows overwhelmingly that when our immigration system is based primarily on people who have much less education and lower ability to be self-sufficient in our country, that displaces the people who are really on the margins of American society. And that turns out to be many people who are minorities or legal immigrants, that they suffer wage depression and displacement from jobs when we have uncontrolled immigration, especially uncontrolled illegal immigration. So we can't ignore those impacts on people who are already struggling in our own country. So that's why we have to enforce the limits that we decide on. And that comes into play with this current crisis, too, because, you know, these people aren't going to be spread evenly across the country. They're coming to places where they already have family and friends, and those may tend to be places that are already struggling to provide enough economic opportunity to people who are already here. So we need to balance our economic needs, our modern economy and its needs, with our desire to help people become Americans. And, you know, that's why it's so difficult, because you have a lot of special interests who are arguing for an unlimited supply of workers, so that they don't have to pay them as much, so that they can bypass U.S. workers, so they don't have to train U.S. workers. And people who are saying, look, we're not, you know, enough is enough. We are not creating enough jobs for Americans. And, you know, there's no economist in this country that will tell you that we have a shortage of unskilled labor. That's not what our economy needs right now. So that's in a nutshell why we've had such trouble, is that, you know, you've got special interests who all benefit from mass immigration on the one hand, and the majority of Americans who realize that there are some downsides.
Okay. Fergus, to you, I know you wanted to jump in, and then Ron, I've got another question for you, and then back to our listeners.
Well, for starters, we do have a shortage of unskilled labor here in New Hampshire, for example. I mean, if you've taken your kids to Storyland this summer, you may have noticed that most of the people working there are young people who are here from other countries on visas. We have shortages in the ski industry here, which is why you might have a Jamaican who's loading you onto the chairlift at Loon Mountain, for example. Apple orchards in New Hampshire. You know, again, we don't have kids growing up or families, parents growing up in Hopkinton aspiring to have their kids picking apples at the orchard down the road. That's just not true. But a lot of it depends on whether you view people, human beings, as assets or as burdens. I suppose I've got three young kids. I suppose I could have picked one up as an infant and said, oh my goodness, what a burden. This child doesn't speak English. This child has no skills. This child is going to be a net drain on society for at least the next 18 years of his or her life. But instead, of course, we look at these children and we imagine what they're going to become. We imagine how they're going to be contributing to society and helping grow our economy instead. And there are some who have this fixed pie view of the world that says that, you know, for one person to get ahead, it can only come at the expense of somebody else. And that's just not a view I share.
Although in cities like Manchester, there has been concern that, you know, taxpayers will have to pick up the bill for the refugee population because they need more English as a second language and so forth. I mean, it's one thing to talk about your own child, but no different
when French Canadian mill workers came into Manchester 100 years ago. No difference.
You know, you mentioned the tech companies, Ron, and you know, wanting to hire people and so forth. We have done programs on the so-called skills gap that manufacturers, especially high-tech manufacturers, complain about here in New Hampshire, and we've gotten calls from folks saying, "Look, you know, I just need a little bit of training. I just need a little bit more schooling." But they feel like the companies don't want to hire them. They'd rather just get an immigrant because it's easier and faster. So there are people in New Hampshire who feel like the immigrants are taking their jobs at that level.
I understand why people might feel that way. That's just not what's going on. I have no business clients who love to have to call me who have to pay immigration filing fees, who have to pay legal fees, who have to wait sometimes 6 months, sometimes years, in order to be able to bring someone in from abroad. That is not how businesses grow and succeed.
So they'd rather have homegrown talent, so to speak.
Absolutely. They would, if they could find people who are here who already have legal employment authorization, they would hire them in a heartbeat. But I look at the petitions I have to prepare, and I have to get conversant with technical issues, particularly in the software context, that I can't even begin to pretend to understand on a substantive level. But I have to be able to present that. These are very specialized skill sets as the information economy continues to develop and evolve, that if there needs to be training, then there should be training. But that's not something my employer clients, my business clients, can do in a timely way to bring these people up to speed.
All right. Well, we've done whole shows on the skills gap, so we'll leave it at that for now. Let's go back to our listeners who want to jump in. And Margaret's waiting in the North Country. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
I'm guests.
Margaret, are you there? Go ahead. Calling from North Conway.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Margaret.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
I can. Go ahead, please.
Okay, good. Good morning. As you can hear from the way I speak, I am an immigrant. And I want to tell you how cumbersome the process is. If the legal immigration process was ordered in a way that ordinary people can actually navigate through it, and it wouldn't be so cumbersome and lengthy and expensive, we wouldn't have an illegal immigration problem.
Margaret, where did you come from?
I came from Canada, but mm-hmm. I'm not originally from Switzerland.
Okay, so you're legal resident, I'm taking it.
Well, of course.
Yeah. And it's a long and cumbersome process. And this
extremely, and in certain ways, degrading.
Degrading?
Yes.
Do you want to jump in on that, Ron? And then I've got another question for Jessica.
Yes. Thank you for calling, Margaret. That is a common refrain I hear from my clients. And sometimes it stems from sort of individual behavior on the part of immigration officials, and in any huge, large bureaucracy, there are going to be some people who live up to the most professional standards and others who don't. But the presumptions in U.S. law are basically against the individual seeking to remain here. So a U.S. citizen who happens to fall in love with a non-U.S. citizen and wishes to petition for that person to be allowed to live here permanently, they are basically on the defensive from the start. And their relationship, their marriage, their intimacy is presumed by law to be fraudulent. They have to disprove that. So let's put that in a non-immigration context. If that was the way you had to speak to your new or your about-to-be new in-laws, you wouldn't feel very good about that relationship. You wouldn't feel very good about what lies ahead. But people have to jump through all these hoops, pay all this money, and essentially be insulted in the process. And those are the ones we're lauding for doing it legally.
Well, Margaret, thanks a lot for the call. And here's an email that came in earlier from Bill in Kittery Point, Maine. I'll throw this to you, Jessica, if I could. He says the whole immigration problem could be stopped cold by enforcing a law already on the books, and you would probably not need any additional immigration employees. Simply arrest, prosecute, send to jail some of the CEOs of companies who employ illegal immigrants and a few of the rich and famous who employ illegals as domestic servants. Bill says not only will the immigrants stop coming, but a good number of those already here will head back home if they're coming for jobs, and as the jobs dry up, so will the stream of illegal immigrants. This is a point that others have made in this discussion before. What do you think, Jessica? Go after the employers.
Well, I think there's really something to that, and worksite enforcement is something that has suffered in recent years. The main reason people come to the United States illegally is because they want to work here. And so it only makes sense that the best way to deter illegal immigration is to make it very difficult for them to find employment, and that starts with the employers. We need to insist that they use proven programs like E-Verify that require employers to verify that the person they're hiring is actually allowed to work in the country. And that would go a long way toward fixing our immigration problem. And we should hold employers accountable. But, you know, I have to, just as a former immigration official, I apologize for any indignities that people have had to suffer at the hands of, you know, any of those officials. But the problem is that the reality is that there are so many fraudulent applications in our legal immigration system. Something like half of all marriage applications turn out to be fraudulent. 70% of all applications for political asylum have markers for fraud. So, you know, this is a very real problem, and comes back to this idea of, you know, if we could make sure that all the right people were able to benefit from our generous legal immigration system, then it would be easier to provide a seamless process for them. But, you know, again, once we decide what the rules are going to be, we have to make sure that they get enforced. And that is sometimes where the rubber meets the road. That's been
right.
The biggest problem in the last few years is that, you know, that pretty much right now, 90% of all the people who are living here illegally are not subject to immigration enforcement. And that's what causes them to get in touch with their friends and family back home and say, look, you know, if you make it to the United States right now, nothing's going to happen to you.
And Jessica, I got to wrap you up there. I do apologize. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time, Jessica, this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Good show.
That's Jessica Vaughn, Director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies. Fergus Cullen, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Fergus Cullen, former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party, founder of Americans by Choice, and Ron Abramson, thank you for your time as well.
Thanks, Laura. Always a pleasure.
Ron Abramson, New Hampshire immigration lawyer, founder of Immigration Solutions. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. $2,000 in Irving Oil Gas gift cards is just the early bird prize in NHPR's summer car raffle. Our grand prize winner gets $25,000 towards a new car from one of Grapponi Automotive Group's dealerships. Ford, Honda, Toyota, Scion, Mazda, or Hyundai. Getting in on the raffle is as easy as buying a $50 ticket or three for $100 at 1-888-805-NHPR or visit nhpr.org today.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Birch Hill Terrace, a not-for-profit continuing care retirement community offering independent living, assisted living, and nursing care in Manchester, birchhillterrace.com. And the Turner Group of Concord, architects, engineers, and building scientists designing energy-efficient, sustainable buildings for a healthy environment, online at hlturner.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Last Thursday, a Malaysian airliner crashed in eastern Ukraine, killing all 298 passengers. The victims came from 11 different countries. U.S. officials now believe the plane was shot down by a missile fired from Russian-backed pro-separatist rebels at war with the Ukraine government. Both Russia and the rebels have denied shooting down the plane. At the crash site, there is growing concern over the integrity of evidence and the bodies of the victims, which are being strictly controlled by rebels. An update on the Malaysian airline crash investigation world outrage, and the escalating global crisis. First is news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Secretary of State John Kerry is heading to Egypt today. He's expected to press Hamas militants to accept a ceasefire that is being proposed by Egypt. More than 500 Palestinians and at least 20 Israelis have now been killed in 2 weeks of fighting. The Israeli military also reports two groups of militants entered Israel through tunnels from Gaza today. NPR's Emily Harris says Israeli troops killed at least 10 militants in a firefight, and the Israeli Air Force bombed the other group.
Militants from Gaza have entered Israel through tunnels several times over the past few days. When Israel began its ground invasion of Gaza last Thursday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it was in large part to destroy the militants' tunnel system. Yesterday, he said that mission is going, quote, fairly quickly. Air and artillery strikes also continue in populated areas of Gaza. Gazan health officials say more than 500 Palestinians have been killed and more than 3,000 wounded during almost 2 weeks of war. Emily Harris, NPR News, Gaza.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says he wants international investigators to have full access to the crash scene of a passenger jet that went down in eastern Ukraine. The U.S. and other nations blame pro-Russian separatists for using a missile to shoot down the jet last week. 298 people were killed. Dutch